I mean, I don't think it's a by accident. I don't think it's just chance that people are, you know, many people feel disengaged from the political process because the major capitalist parties are very much disengaged from them. The people, ordinary working people, don't see their interests or their concerns very well represented by the liberals or the conservatives. And unfortunately, we have this first-past-the-post system. You know, the government is going to be composed of the party that gets more votes than the other party, rather than really representing across the board the different diverse points of view of the voters. Until we have a proportional representation,
which is something that you obviously would advocate.
Yeah, we've had that in our program for a long time. Yeah. So it's not an accident that people feel disengaged from the political process because they're hard pressed to find a party that really represents their interests that they feel has any chance of being elected or forming a government.
And evidently, at least the two parties that have historically held power in this country these days represent business concerns to a much greater extent than those of individuals.
Oh, yes. The Liberal Party's always been a capitalist party, but it's, you know, over the last couple of decades, it's become so much more so just a tool of the multinational corporations. And, of course, the so-called conservatives never were anything except that. Unfortunately, it's hard work to form the kind of coalition of democratic forces that can actually fight an election because the way the election rules are set up, mitigates against that. The rules don't fit coalition politics very well.
Do you think that there are other reasons, aside from the ones that we've already gone through, for this, I guess it could be apathy as well as disengagement?
Well, it's more subtle than just who you vote for, whether the person you vote for becomes a member of parliament. Because we have a party political system, not individuals. And so the problem is really that these parties represent a different class than the great majority of the voters. The majority of people are working class or, small business or farmers. And the interests of those classes are simply not reflected in the policies of the liberals or the conservatives.
Other than proportional representation, I would guess that you have other solutions or suggestions for solutions that would encourage people to participate more. Is that true? Or?
Mm-hmm. Well, the Communist Party is in favor of socialism. That means we think the working class should be the ruling class. There's a lot implied by that. That means not just that people go and mark their ballot once every 4 years, but they actually have to be involved in running their workplace, running the economy, running the government. When you're a part of the ruling class, you have to actually participate in these kinds of things. So we're actually calling on people to be much more deeply involved in the political process on an ongoing basis.
If we view proportional representation of one method of reforming the government, I guess that implies that you don't have the feeling that our current system of government is beyond reform, as some people do.
Well, there's room for improvement, let's say. But the really profound reforms that we're interested in would be nationalization of major corporations and putting working people in charge. So that involves not just a matter of, scraping up a majority of seats in parliament, but a really aroused and involved working class that's going to participate in those kinds of activities on an ongoing basis. So we run in elections. That's not the only thing we do, right? Because what the really important work is building up those coalitions of democratic movements that could, can possibly take power in the long term.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the sort of work that happens when you're not actually running a formal election campaign. Yeah, there's certainly room for improvement in Canada of making the formal electoral process more democratic. But to make the society really more democratic, we need really profound social and economic changes, and a change in the balance of power between the classes in society.
One suggestion that's come up with a few of the other people I've spoken with is the idea of mandatory voting. Do you have any thoughts?
I don't know that that's going to be much more democratic than the system we've got now. Unless people have the option of voting none of the above, from our point of view, that's heading in the opposite direction in terms of the concept of how you would solve this problem. What we're interested in is seeing, mass organizations like the union movement, the women's movement, the environmentalists, the farmers, the students, immigrant organizations, all kinds of popular democratic organizations joining together and developing an alternate program of their own of what they want the government to do. A democratic and, we hope, a socialist program. And when people have done that, when there really is an alternate program in place that people adhere to and subscribe to, there wouldn't be no problem getting them to vote for it. Developing a program for government that's worth voting for, it seems to me, is the way to solve the problem of getting people to vote, rather than simply herding them to the polls with the same dreary choices that they have now, mm-hmm. between dumb and dumber, right?
Right, and proportional representation obviously goes a long way to...
That would be a help in that it would at least allow people to vote for what they're in favor of, rather than, voting against what they're most against.
I have a feeling that in this upcoming election, a lot of people are voting against something rather than for something.
Yeah. Well, there's a sort of a mechanism that seems to come into play, really, in a lot of elections, where the newspapers and TV and the pollsters and so on, they come up with this description of what they expect the voters to do, and they typically make it look as if it's more to the right than what actually happens on voting day. So that has two effects. One thing is it spooks the liberals, it pushes them even further right in terms of their propaganda and their campaigning and their promises. But it also spooks the more progressive people who are so horrified at the prospect of Harper and his gang getting in that a lot of them will be frightened into voting liberal, which is every bit as much a capitalist party, even though they'd really much rather vote NDP or even communist if they were expressing their own views and their own aspirations.
Have you noticed that in this election campaign, the NDP seems to be, in some ways, making overtures towards what has conventionally been the center, although I guess you could easily argue that the center has gone quite right?
I don't know that they have. I think... Leighton's a fairly vigorous leader there the NDP does vacillate a bit. We're quite prepared to cooperate with them and work with them in terms of, some policies where we could come to an agreement. But any party that places its whole reliance on just election campaigns is going to be liable to have that tendency, to find itself kind of dragged into a sort of short-term public relations maneuvers during an election campaign, rather than laying out what they really believe in principle, because the NDP, by giving themselves a mandate of sticking strictly to electoral politics, limits themselves to that. The Communist Party doesn't. There are things that we agree with the NDP about, and things that we might not agree. But one thing is that our strategy is not to limit ourselves to electoral campaigns. We think that the alliance building that happens in between campaigns, when people fight and often in opposition to the government, and people fight for what they need and what they believe in, like for jobs, for improvement in working conditions, for human rights, for equality, for peace, all those things, that's where the really important long-term alliances are forged that can, in fact, make a difference for real reform in the electoral or the political system.
I find it odd how our system of government is often defined by people who live south of the border as socialist. It doesn't seem entirely accurate.
Yeah. Well, I'm not quite sure what all the reasons are for, you know, but essentially I just think that, you know, the American political system is stunted, underdeveloped, and their political discourse is stunted. They just don't know the meanings of words. Everywhere else in the world, people understand the difference between, you know, social democrats, socialists, communists, liberals, conservatives. It's as if the U.S. has a completely different set of terminology because they don't even, you know, have a grasp of these basic concepts because they've never developed a multi-party system.
I wanted to talk to you about how the Canadian government tried to silence the voices of the minor political parties. Mm-hmm. Some years back. Can you first of all tell us about how they attempted to do that?
Yeah. Well, this was you could call it almost the last act of the Mulroney government, that they passed changes in the Elections Act, which were really very draconian and had the effect of attempting to destroy smaller parties, because if you didn't have at least 50 candidates in the election, not only would you lose your official registration so that the name of the party wouldn't appear on the ballot, you couldn't issue receipts, you know, tax receipts for donations to the party like all the others, but they actually included that the party's assets would be seized by the government. And, you know, ours were. Well, we developed a court case. We took them to court. This went to the Supreme Court just a little over a year ago. Mm-hmm. They gave their judgment, and we won this at every level of the courts, like starting in Ontario where it was first brought, you know, going up through the various appeals. So many of the worst aspects of that, those changes in the Elections Act, were overturned. They were ruled to be unconstitutional, and they had a year to make the changes in the act, which the outgoing Liberal government just, you know, finished passing the required changes in compliance with the Supreme Court about 3 days before the election was called.
Were these changes originally supported by other parties like the Liberals? I'm guessing probably not the NDP.
Well, they did. Actually, they voted for it. I think it was just kind of rushed through. You know, I don't know that they even had a chance to read it. It's hard to imagine that the NDP would have voted for it if they'd read what was in it, because our jaws certainly dropped when we read it. You know, we hadn't realized that this was coming as a bill, you know, way back at that point. And it came as quite a surprise that they'd done something so high-handed and anti-democratic for no good reason that we could even tell. You know, it's not as if they don't really require administrative arbitrary methods to prevent the Rhinoceros Party from forming the government.
Well, I was just thinking, as you described the process going up through the courts, presumably the government of the day, being the Liberals, would have taken the decision that they were going to appeal these decisions.
Well, you could understand that the parties that have a majority of seats, that somehow or another, the argument that large parties ought to have unfair advantages doesn't seem quite so unfair to them. It's just the same way that capitalists can always seem to be able to find good arguments for why, you know, an exploitative system like capitalism is a good idea. Sure, it's in their own interest, and, you know, it's very hard for them to have the breadth of vision and the objectivity to see that it's not democratic. So I don't pretend to be, inside the inner councils. I don't know exactly who thought what or what they were thinking or why they, you know, decided to. But in fact, the government's lawyers argued in defense of these indefensible changes in the Elections Act right up to the Supreme Court, but they were defeated.
Well, they were defeated, but the assets that were seized at the time, mm-hmm. Have you gotten them back?
Oh, no, no, we haven't gotten back yet. That's still to come. I mean, they still have to. We still have to possibly go squabble with them some more.
So they'll be. This is going to be before the courts again.
It possibly it will. Well, there are in the changes which they brought in just before this election was called. There are some other aspects, although some of the worst aspects that the court told them were unconstitutional,
mm-hmm.
have been removed. They did. They put in some other things which we think, which we're considering whether, you know, we shouldn't be fighting those and trying to get those overturned as well.
What, for instance?
Well, as opposed to, instead of having to have a certain number of candidates across the country to obtain or to maintain a party's registration, they're talking about having a certain number of party members have to sign a declaration that they are members of that party. Now, that doesn't look so bad on the face of it, but we're the Communist Party. We don't want to give them a list of 250 of our members.
Is that the number, 250?
I believe that's it. That's kind of what sticks in my mind. I'm not absolutely certain, but I think it's 250, yeah. So, I don't know if you were... was as big a news story in Ontario as in Alberta. But just a few weeks ago, the Premier of Alberta, Ralph Klein, made some comments in the legislature praising Pinochet for his fascist coup in Chile, where
he
overthrew the government, the elected government, and murdered, you know, thousands of people. We don't want to give governments like that our names.
Yeah, that seems.
I don't think Ralph Klein's in a position to carry out his, you know, his actual personal opinion that people like us should be rounded up. But he blurted it out, you know, and so he must think that it's that this is an allowable shade of political opinion. Well, we don't agree, so you know we may have to go back to court about that, but. You know, that in a way, though, some of that is a technical decision. When you start taking things to court, it's not based strictly on ideas of justice or democracy. It's also based on the technicalities of what, you know, what can courts do and what can lawyers do.
So. I'm very interested because you're out west, and that's a it's generally regarded as the seat of conservative power.
Uh-huh.
I wonder if you have any views on well, first of all, if that's even an accurate picture that gets painted.
Yeah. Well, there is, you know, a somewhat larger percentage of the popular vote goes to the Conservatives in Alberta than it does in most other provinces. Mm-hmm. But because of this clumsy and undemocratic system we have, that means a great majority of the seats go to them, you know, in Parliament. So... Yes, it's true. There are, you know, it's more conservative in that sense. There are a larger number of conservative people. The trade union movement is not strong in Alberta because it's not well industrialized. There's not a lot of major, you know, industrial developments where workers would be concentrated and organized. And you know, this is reflected in all aspects of the politics and the society. But I think it's very much exaggerated by the political system we have. This is far from unanimous. There's lots of people in Alberta who don't agree with the Conservatives.
Another thought that I had was regarding the union movement.
Mm-hmm.
It seems today that unions are in a position where they're not exactly doing the job that they're supposed to. Do you understand what I mean by that, first of all?
We certainly have some views like that, and I don't know if you and I are meaning exactly the same thing by it.
Well, they have. They seem to be negotiating concessions to corporations on behalf of their workers rather than really standing up for their workers. Some of these corporations are making record profits at the same time.
Well, yeah, you just put it in a nutshell, all right. But our view is it's hard to not make concessions. If all you do is negotiate with the one boss, right, like the one set of workers with their employer across the table, that's a kind of divide and conquer mechanism that the boss can use. In order to have a really strong defense of working conditions, so that they're not making concessions or even making progress in their negotiations, nowadays, the unions can't just negotiate contracts. They have to become more active on the political scale. They have to be able to run campaigns where they involve not only their own members, but draw in broader sections of the working class, you know, in defense of working conditions generally, you know, in defense of jobs and, you know, preventing industries from closing down, protecting the environment. You know, a lot of issues that can't really, that a single local or a single union is not going to be able to enforce in, you know, it's not going to be able to extract in a contract. So it's really important for the trade union movement to have its political aspect, to have an independent political campaign in defense of its interests. To the extent that they don't do that, they are going to be picked off one by one, you know, and like concessions will be imposed in, you know, plant by plant, sector by sector.
It seems like that's exactly what's happening.
Yeah.
So your solution to this is I guess a stronger cooperation between unions and building in order to further a political agenda.
Yeah. There's not going to be improvement until the union movement is united, and militant and engaged on a broader level than just the economic negotiations, engaged in a political fight back.